Hello and welcome to this First Look Exploring session, looking at Bosworth Field by Sir John Beaumont, published posthumously in 1629. His son published it a year after his unfortunate demise. I don't know how unfortunate it was. I don't know. I assume he actually died at a perfectly reasonable age. I don't know. I haven't done the research. We are looking at this poem. It's not a play, but we have formatted it to be a little bit of a play as we go through it as pacily as we can, stopping and starting to have a little chat about it as we go. So, to read through this particular text, we have this crack team of readers joining us today to read the narrator. Narrator number one is...
Hello, I'm Emma Kemp. I'm an actor and I'm in London.
And narrator one is primarily on the side of Richard III, not on the side of Richard III, reading they, Norfolk, Stanley, Richmond, Percy, Surrey, Scout, Byron and Catesby, all of them, is...
Liza Graham, actor, singer, text coach, two actors and general theatre bod in London.
Reading Henry VI, the ghost thereof, Brackenbury, Ferrers, Talbot, Bouchier and Clifton is...
Hi, I'm Eric. I was looking for something. I can't find it. This is a story of my life. It's fine.
And reading Richard III as well as Oxford and Hungerford is...
Hi, I'm Gina Morvec. I'm a voice actor and podcast producer in the US.
And I'm your host, Robert Crichton. I'll be reading narrator number two. Narrator number two is mostly following on the Richmond side. It's one of those texts where, of course, lots of different names occur. And one of the questions about turning this into a more performy text, which is sort of the plan, is to ask the question about how clear certain people the text is about who certain people are at certain points. So I'll just say for the record now, a lot of the time whenever Richmond, otherwise known as later on as Henry the Seventh, sometimes referred to as just the Earl. That said, there are other Earls available, just to be moderately confusing. And of course, the problem with the sound of Richmond is, of course, it's remarkably similar to Richard. Richard is obviously frequently referred to as the king because he is still the king at this point. Though, spoilers, he won't be for very long. For those who don't want to know the result of the Battle of Bosworth, please look away now. So without further ado, we're going to dive into the text, see how clearly it flows, see if there's any minor intervention we might do for a performance of this and see how it flows. So Bosworth Field by Sir John Beaumont, narrator number one, take it away.
The winter storm of civil war I sing, whose end is crowned with our eternal spring, where roses joined, their colours mixed in one, and armies fight no more for England's throne. Thou, gracious Lord, direct my feeble pen, who, from the actions of ambitious men, hast by thy goodness drawn our joyful good, and made sweet flowers and olives grow from blood, while we, delighted with this fair release, may climb Parnassus in the days of peace. The king, whose eyes were never fully closed, whose mind oppressed with fearful dreams supposed that he in blood had wallowed all the night, leaps from his restless bed before the light. Accursed Tyrrell is the first he spies, whom, threatening with his dagger, thus he cries.
How darest thou, villain, so disturb my sleep? Were not the smothered children buried deep? And hath the ground again been ripped by thee, that I their rotten carcasses might see?
The wretch, astonished, hastes away to slide, as damned ghosts themselves in darkness hide, and calls up three, whose counsels could assage the sudden swellings of the prince's rage. Ambitious Lovell, who, to gain his grace, had stained the honour of his noble race. Perfidious Catesby, by whose curious skill the law was taught to speak his master's will. And Ratcliffe, deeply learned in courtly art, who best could search into his sovereign's heart. Affrighted Richard labours to relate his hideous dreams as signs of hapless fate.
Alas, said they, such fictions children fear. These are not terrors showing danger near, but motives sent by some propitious power to make you watchful at this early hour. These prove that your victorious care prevents your slothful foes that slumber in their tents. This precious time must not in vain be spent, which God, your help, by heavenly means hath lent.
He, By these false conjectures, much appeased, contemning fancies which his mind diseased, replies,
I should have been ashamed to tell, found dreams to wise men, whether heaven or hell or troubled nature these effects have wrought. I know this day requires another thought. If some resistless strength my cause should cross, fear will increase and not redeem the loss. All dangers clouded with the midst of fear seem great far off, but lessen coming near. Away, ye black illusions of the night. If ye combined with fortune have the might to hinder my designs, ye shall not bear my courage seeking glorious death in war.
Thus being cheered, he calls aloud for arms and bids that all should rise whom Morpheus charms.
Bring me, saith he, the harness that I wore at Turkesbury, which from that day no more hath felt the batteries of a civil strife, nor stood between destruction and my life.
Upon his breastplate he beholds a dint, which in that field young Edward's sword did print. This stirs remembrance of his heinous guilt, when he that prince's blood so foully spilt. Now, fully armed, he takes his helmet bright, which, like a twinkling star, with trembling light, sends radiant luster through the darksome air. This mask will make his wrinkled visage fair. But when his head is covered with the steel, he tells his servants that his temples feel deep piercing stings, which breed unusual pains, and of the heavy burden much complains. Some mark his words as tokens framed to express the sharp conclusion of a sad success. Then, going forth and finding in his way a soldier of the watch who sleeping lay, enraged to see the wretch neglect his part, he strikes a sword into his trembling heart. The hand of death and iron dullness takes those leaden eyes, which natural ease forsakes. The king this morning sacrifice commends, and for example, thus the fact defends. I leave him as I found him, fit to keep the silent doors of everlasting sleep.
Still Richmond slept, for worldly care and fear have times of pausing when the soul is clear, while heaven's director, whose revengeful brow would to the guilty head no rest allow, looks on the other part with milder eyes. At his command, an angel swiftly flies from sacred truth's perspicuous gate to bring a crystal vision on his golden wing. This lord, thus sleeping, though he saw and knew his lamb-like uncle whom that tiger slew, whose powerful words encourage him to fight.
Go on, just scourge of murder, virtue's light, the combat which thou shalt this day endure, makes England's peace for many ages sure. Thy strong invasion cannot be withstood, the earth assists thee with the cry of blood. The heaven shall bless thy hopes and crown thy joy. See how the fiends with loud and dismal noise, presaging vultures greedy of their prey, on Richard's tent their scaly wings display.
The holy king then offered to his view a lively tree on which three branches grew. But when the hope of fruit had made him glad, all fell to dust, at which the earl was sad. Yet comfort comes again when from the root he sees a bough into the north to shoot, which nourished there extends itself from thence and girds this land with a firm defence. There he beholds a high and glorious throne, where sits a king by laurel garlands known, like bright Apollo in the Muses' choirs. His radiant eyes are watchful, heavenly fires. Beneath his pale feet, envy bites her chain, and sneaky discord wets her sting in vain.
Thou seest, said Henry, wise and potent James, this is he whose happy union tames the savage feuds, and shall those let deface which keep the borders from a dear embrace. Both nations shall in Britain's royal crown their differing names, the signs of faction drown. The silver streams which from this spring increase bedew all Christian hearts with drops of peace. Observe how hopeful Charles is born to assuage the winds that would disturb this golden age. When that great king shall full of glory leave the earth is base, then may this prince receive the diadem. Without his father's wrong, may he take it late and may possess it long. Above all Europe's princes, shine thou bright, O God's selected care and man's delight.
Here gentle sleep forsook his clouded brows, and full of holy thoughts and pious vows, he kissed the ground as soon as he arose. When watchful Digby, who among his foes had wandered unsuspected all the night, reports that Richard is prepared to fight. And we'll just pause there. We've got a little way into the text as a sort of sense of momentum to it all. Seeing how it's getting a sense of how it's flowing. Thoughts on the room? Is anyone hopelessly lost? It's fine if you are. Is everyone following broadly where we are? It's easier, of course, for us reading it because we can see that certain figures that they're not necessarily clearly described Henry the Sixth is Henry the Sixth, because we can see the name written down there. But the reader and the listener otherwise might go, oh, who's that? Oh, which one's that one again? Who's this? And which are they? Thoughts on the room. Following, not following? Clear? Unclear? Liza.
Well, for a moment I was confused. When Richard orders the armor he wore at Tewkesbury, I was confused when the narrator mentioned that there was a dint made by young Edward, who Richard slew. But I believe that means Henry VI's son, Edward of Westminster, Prince of Wales. An awful lot of people named Edward in that war.
There's a lot of people with the same name or similar names, or of course, similar titles, because they're related to people with different titles, or the titles passed to different people, and as opposed to their actual names or their family names. History's a sod, as it were. That's going into sort of past history. I particularly like the sort of casual taking out of someone on watch who's not been paying attention. There's immediate action, as well as we're straight into, you know, the battle's about to happen. There's no preamble really going on there. Liza?
It reads to me as a sort of metaphor that the first death in the poem is Richard killing one of his own men. And I think this is supposed to, you know, this takes the... This poem as a whole takes a very Tudor view of Richard III as very much a bad guy. And the killing of the watchman could be read as a metaphor for how Richard harmed his own country. Not that I condone any particular view of Richard III, but, I mean, who knows? The fellow is dead. He probably did some good and bad things.
Eric?
I was just wondering, chronologically, where does this sit compared to other poems like... what's called Astrophil and Stella or something, because like it has that structure of like, you know, narration then speech then narration then speech, much like Astrophil and Stella, which is completely different and romantic and stuff, but yeah,
there's a good 40-50 years between the two of certainly those two texts.
And Astrophil is a little different in that it's very much, it's a sonnet sequence with occasional songs told in the first person by a lover.
And we haven't really done enough poetry yet, so the precise, you know, pure form poetry, that's something we mean to correct as we go forward. Anyway, we've just left Richmond. Richmond's woken up, and we're popping back to Richard.
Long since the king had thought it time to send for trusty Norfolk, his undaunted friend, who, hasting from the place of his abode, found at the door a world of papers strewed. Some would affright him from the tyrant's side, affirming that his master was betrayed. Some laid before him all those bloody deeds, from which a line of sharp revenge proceeds, with much compassion, that so brave a knight should serve a lord against whom angels fight. And others put suspicions in his mind, that Richard, most observed, was most unkind. The Duke a while these cautious words revolves, with serious thoughts, and thus at last resolves.
If all the camp prove traitors to my lord, shall spotless Norfolk falsify his word? Mine oath is past. I swore to uphold his crown, and that shall swim, or I with it will drown. It is too late now to dispute the right. Dare any tongue since York spread forth his light, Northumberland or Buckingham defame two valiant Cliffords, Ross or Beaumont's name, because they in the weaker quarrel die? They had the king with them, and so have I. But every eye the face of Richard shuns for that foul murder of his brother's sons. Yet laws of knighthood gave me not a sword to strike at him whom all with joint accord have made my prince, to whom I tribute bring. I hate his vices, but adore the king. Victorious Edward, if thy soul can hear thy servant Howard, I devoutly swear that to have saved thy children from that day, my hopes on earth should willingly decay. Would Gloucester then my perfect faith had tried, and made two graves when noble Hastings died.
This said, his troops he into order draws, then double haste redeems his former pause. So stops the sailor for a voyage bound, when on the sea he hears the tempest sound, till pressing hunger to remembrance sends, that on his course his household's life depends. With this he clears the doubts that vexed his mind, and puts his ship to mercy of the wind. The Duke's stout presence and courageous looks were to the king as falls of sliding brooks, which bring a gentle and delightful rest to weary eyes with grievous care oppressed. He bids that Norfolk and his hopeful son, whose rising fame in arms this day began, should lead the vanguard, for so great a command he dares not trust in any other hand. The rest he to his own advice refers, and as the spirit in that body stirs, then putting on his crown, a fatal sign, so offered beasts near death in garlands shine, he rides about the ranks and strives to inspire each breast with part of his unwearied fire. To those who had his brother's servants been, and had the wonders of his valor seen, he saith,
"My fellow soldiers, though your swords are sharp and need not whetting by my words, yet call to mind those many glorious days in which we treasured up immortal praise. If when I served, I ever fled from foe, fly ye from mine, let me be punished so. But if my father, when at first he tried how all his sons could shining blades abide, found me an eagle whose undazzled eyes affront the beams which from the steel arise, and if I now in action teach the same, know then, ye have but changed your general's name. But still yourselves, ye fight against the dross of those that oft have run from you with loss. How many Somersets, dissensions, brands have felt the force of our revengeful hands? From whom this youth has from a princely flood derives his best, yet not untainted blood, have our assaults made Lancaster to drop? And shall this Welshman with his ragged troop subdue the Norman and the Saxon line, that only Merlin may be thought divine? See what a guide these fugitives have chose, who bred among the French our ancient foes, forgets the English language and the ground, and knows not what our drums and trumpets sound."
To others' minds, their willing oaths he draws. He tells his just decrees and helpful laws, and makes large proffers of his future grace. Thus, having ended, with as cheerful face as nature, which his stepdam still was thought, could lend to one without proportion wrought. Some with loud shouting make the valleys ring, but most with murmur sigh.
God save the king.
Now careful Henry sends his servant Bray to Stanley, who accounts it safe to stay and dares not promise, lest his haste should bring his son to death, now prisoner with the king.
About the same time, Brackenbury came, and thus, to Stanley say, in Richard's name,
"My lord, the king salutes you, and commands that to his aid you bring your ready bands, or else he swears by him that sits on high, before the armies join, your son shall die."
At this the lord stood, like a man that hears the judge's voice, which condemnation bears, till gathering up his spirits, he replies,
"My fellow Hastings' death hath made me wise, more than my dream could him, for I no more will trust the tushes of the angry boar. If with my George's blood he stain his throne, I thank my God I have more sons than one. Yet to secure his life, I quiet stand against the king, not lifting up my hand."
The messenger departs, of hope denied.
Then noble Stanley, taking Bray aside, saith,
"Let my son proceed without despair, assisted by his mother's alms and prayer. God will direct both him and me to take best courses for that blessed woman's sake."
The Earl, by this delay, was not inclined to fear nor anger, knowing Stanley's mind. But calling all his chief commanders near, he boldly speaks while they attentive hear.
"It is in vain, brave friends, to show the right which we are forced to seek by civil fight. Our swords are brandished in a noble cause to free your country from a tyrant's laws. That angry planet, what disastrous sign directs Plantagenet's afflicted line? Ah, was it not enough that mutual rage in deadly battles should this race engage, till by their blows themselves they fewer make, and pillars fall which France could never shake? But must this crooked monster now be found to lay rough hands on that unclosed wound? His secret plots have much increased the flood. He, with his brothers and his nephew's blood, hath stained the brightness of his father's flowers, and made his own white rose as red as ours. This is the day whose splendor puts to flight obscuring clouds and brings an age of light. We see no hindrance of those wished times, but this usurper whose depressing crimes will drive him from the mountain where he stands, so that he must needs fall without our hands. In this we happy are, that by our arms both York and Lancaster revenge their harms. Here Henry's servants join with Edward's friends, and leave their private griefs for public ends."
Thus ceasing, he implores the Almighty's grace, and bids that every captain take his place. His speech was answered with a general noise of acclamations, doubtless signs of joys, which soldiers uttered as they forward went, the sure forerunners of a fair event. So when the winter to the spring bequeaths the rule of time, and mild Favonius breathes, a choir of swans to that sweet music sings, the air resounds the motion of their wings, when over plains they fly in ordered ranks, to sport themselves upon Caister's banks.
I'll just pause there. I should have given that to me, actually. That was a Richmond follow-on. Never mind. Don't worry. Yeah. That's just me twiddling around with who should say things. I must have done that one quickly. Okay, some interesting stuff here. The murmuring crowd, God save the king. I do like that. Most with murmur sigh. No enthusiasm from this army at all. It's a really interesting speech from Richard as well. At that point, it's not the most exciting of battle cries in the way it's put together, and actually I'm not sure Richmond's is either. It doesn't feel like they're doing the sort of thing you would have in a stage play where it's, you know, you build to a sort of high point. I'm not sure they're structured that way. I'm not sure. We're building towards a battle, and we've got two messengers sent to the same person, to Stanley, who's got to make a choice, and is sort of negotiating where he stands. And of course, basically, Stanley stands on the fence. He's a very uncomfortable position to be in. There's splinters everywhere. How are people, especially those reading characters, are you getting a sense that your characters have definition? How are you feeling about that? Either, you know, Norfolk, Richard, Richmond, Stanley, any of the smaller ones. Are we feeling that that there's character differentiation going on? I'll go to Gina, then Liza.
I'm coming at this probably a little bit differently, as I don't have the historical background of this piece, probably that some others do on the panel. But it's funny how you mentioned at the beginning, you gave the spoilers about who wins this battle at the end. But honestly, by page 2-3, even if I didn't have that information, I could have figured that out on my own. Because it's very, we touched about on this earlier, it's kind of obvious through this author who's going to win, or at the very least, who is being favored through this. Even like reading Richard's parts and then going forward and seeing everybody else's part, just seeing how Richard is not the one being built up in this story, essentially. There might be a couple comments here and there, but even the masses or the groups of people that are around him, when they're talking back, they're not exclamatory, they're not joyous. It's almost like we're doing it because we have to. So I think it's kind of easy to pick up on that.
Stanley's talking about, well, I've seen other people who've disagreed with Richard dying horrible deaths. That's why I will stick with the king, possibly. Nobody's an enthusiast here. Liza.
Well, having read both Norfolk and Stanley, Norfolk, that's a really interesting speech because he basically is saying, I don't like the king particularly, but I took an oath to him and my knighthood and lordship depend on it, so I'm going to be loyal to that oath. Whereas Stanley says, well, I would be against him, but he's got my son as a hostage, so I'm just going to kind of, I'm nominally on his side, but I'm not going to actually help him. Of the two, which is the stronger position? Who knows? In the world of this poem, the character of Richard, the poet doesn't really question that the character of Richard doesn't deserve his subject's loyalty. In fact, he's a blot on the throne, and Henry needs to avenge both his own house of Lancaster and those members of York whom Richard killed by removing him. But Richard's pre-battle speech is really strong. It emphasizes his personal bravery. There's a wonderful couplet. When I served, I ever fled from foe. Fly ye from mine. You've all frozen. Is that, am I still
here?
No,
you're okay. Still with us.
Anyway, Richard, Richard emphasizes his personal bravery and track record in war, which is not questioned. He was a very good fighter, and even his enemies had to admit that.
Okay, let's get a little more data, a little further into the action, as we are going to now get into unpacking war battle stuff as battle is joined. Bold Oxford leads the vanguard up amain, whose valiant offers heretofore were vain, when he his love to Lancaster expressed, but now with more indulgent fortune blessed, his men he toward Norfolk's quarter drew, and straight the one the other ensigns knew, for they in several armies were displayed, this oft in Edward's, that in Henry's aid. The sad remembrance of those bloody fights incensed new anger in these noble knights. A marsh lay between, which Oxford leaves upon his right hand, and the sun receives behind him with advantage of the place, for Norfolk must endure it on his face, and yet his men advance their spears and swords against his succour, which the heaven affords. His horse and foot possessed the field in length, while bowmen went before them for their strength. Thus marching forth, they set on Oxford's band. He fears their number, and with strict command, his soldiers closely to the standard draws.
Then Howard's troops, amazed, begin to pause. They doubt the slights of battle and prepare to guard their valour with a trench of care.
This sudden stop made warlike Veer more bold to see their fury in a moment cold. His ranks he in a larger form displays, which all were archers, counted in those days, the best of English soldiers for their skill, could guide their shafts according to their will. The feathered wood they from their bows let fly, no arrow fell, but caused some man to die. So painful bees with forward gladness strive to join themselves in throngs before the hive, and with obedience till that hour attend, when their commander shall his watchword send. Then to the winds their tender sails they yield, depress the flowers, depopulate the field.
Wise Norfolk, to avoid these shafts the more, contrives his battle thin and sharp before. He thus attempts to pierce into the heart and break the orders of the adverse part. As when the cranes direct their flight on high to cut their way, they in a trigon fly, which pointed figure may with ease divide opposing blasts through which they swiftly glide.
But now the wings make haste to Oxford's aid. The left by valiant Savage was displayed. His lusty soldiers were attired in white. They move like drifts of snow, whose sudden fright constrains the weary passenger to stay, and beating on his face confounds his way. Brave Talbot led the right, whose grandsire's name was his continual spur to purchase fame. Both these rushed in.
While Norfolk, like a wall, which oft with engines cracked, disdains to fall, maintains his station by defensive fight, till Surrey, pressing forth with youthful might, sends many shadows to the gates of death. When dying mouths had gasped forth purple breath, his father follows. Age and former pains had made him slower, yet he still retains his ancient vigour, and with much delight to see his son do marvels in his sight, he seconds him, and from the branches cleaves those clusters which the former vintage leaves.
Now Oxford flies as lightning through his troops, and with his presence cheers the part that droops. His brave endeavours Surrey's force restrain, like banks at which the ocean storms in vain.
The swords and armour shine as sparkling coals. Their clashing drowns the groans of parting souls. The peaceful neighbours, who had long desired to find the causes of their fear expired, are newly grieved to see this scarlet flood and English ground bedewed with English blood.
Stout Rhys and Herbert lead the power of Wales. Their zeal to Henry moves the hills and dales to sound their countrymen's beloved name, who shall restore the British offspring's frame. These make such slaughter with their galves and hooks that careful bards may fill their precious books with praises which from warlike actions spring and take new themes when to their harps they sing. Besides these soldiers born within this isle, we must not of their part the French beguile, whom Charles for Henry's succour did provide, a lord of Scotland, Bernard was their guide, a blossom of the Stuart's happy line, which is on England's throne ordained to shine. The sun whose rays the heaven with beauty crown, from his ascending to his going down, saw not a braver leader in that age. And Bosworth Field must be the glorious stage in which this northern eagle learns to fly and tries those wings which after raise him high, when he beyond the snowy Alps renowned shall plant French lilies in Italian ground and cause the craggy Apennine to know what fruits on Caledonian mountains grow. Now in this civil war the troops of France their banners dare on English air advance, and on their lances' points destruction bring to fainting servants of the guilty king. When heretofore they had no power to stand against our armies in their native land, but melting fled as wax before the flame, dismayed with thunder of St. George's name. Now Henry, with his uncle Pembroke, moves the rearward on, and Stanley then approves his love to Richmond's person and his cause. He from his army of 3,000 draws a few choice men, and bids the rest obey his valiant brother, who shall prove this day as famous as great Warwick, in whose hand the fate of England's crown was thought to stand. With these he closely steals to help his friend, while his main forces stir not, but attend the younger Stanley.
And to Richard's eye, appear not parties, but as standers by. Yet Stanley's words, so much the king incense, that he exclaims,
"This is a false pretense. His doubtful answer shall not save his son. Young Strange shall die. See, Catesby, this be done."
Now, like a lamb, which taken from the folds, the slaughterman with rude embraces holds, and for his throat prepares a whetted knife. So goes this harmless lord to end his life. The axe is sharpened, and the block prepared. But worthy Ferrers, equal portion shared, of grief and terror which the prisoner felt, his tender eyes in tears of pity melt, and hasting to the king, he boldly said,
"My lord, too many bloody stains are laid by envious tongues upon your peaceful reign. So may their malice ever speak in vain, afford not this advantage to their spite. None should be killed today but in the fight. Your crown is strongly fixed, your cause is good. Cast not upon it drops of harmless blood. His life is nothing, yet will dearly cost, if while you seek it, we perhaps have lost. Occasions of your conquest thither fly, where rebels armed with cursed blades must die, shall die, and yield in death to your victorious all. Let naked hands be censured by the law."
Such power his speech and seemly action hath, it mollifies the tyrant's bloody wrath, and he commands that Strange's death be stayed. The noble youth, who was before dismayed at death's approaching sight, now sweetly clears his cloudy sorrows and forgets his fears, as when a steer to burning altars led, expecting fatal blows to cleave his head, as by the priest for some religious cause sent back to live, and now in quiet draws the open air, and takes his wonted food, and never thinks how near to death he stood. The king, though ready, yet his march delayed, to have Northumberland's expected aid to him, industrious Ratcliffe swiftly hies.
And we're just going to pause before we get to some Ratcliffe action. Okay, we've got an awful... we had this a bit in the first sort of section. We've got an awful lot. Every so often, someone has to mention that, you know, all of this leads to the Stuarts. You know, our king, kings we have now. It's all great, isn't it? It's all great. We've got these wonderful people. They won't in any way undermine the monarchy. Projection to future things. Yeah, and so every so often it goes off on this tangent to just say how great James and his lot are, which slightly takes the wind out of its sails, because I was sort of really getting into some of the battle formation stuff. I don't know how clear that came across. Maybe I was just enjoying descriptions of precisely where people were. There was one particular line. There was something about... The soldiers all dressed in white, like it's sort of advancing snow. There's some really nice images painted of what the battle looks like, and the different formations of soldiers which just seem to actually vaguely connect to accounts of what actually was going on. So there's some accurate stuff in there. Though how accurate is as ever an interesting question. Thoughts in the room? Who wants to leap in on some of this? Everyone's very quiet tonight. Come on, people, don't make me constantly talk. Eric.
As someone who's not particularly familiar with this part of history, or, well, any part of history, I'm more familiar with the place than I am with the actual history. I feel like I need, like, sort of color coding, but I don't know if that's, like, who's on whose side kind of thing. But I don't, obviously you wouldn't be able to get that in an audio medium. Depending on how you produce it, you could, like, it depends what you intend to do with this kind of material, because it could be very visually beautiful and sort of stirring and that kind of thing, in terms of, as you said, like, the language is sort of supports that. But you could also just sort of leave it to the imagination kind of thing, but you'd need some way of telling apart who's on whose side if you're not entirely sure what's going on.
One of the reasons I split the narrators approximately to each side. It didn't always work because I sometimes forget who's on whose side. Was to try and sort of make that a bit of logic there. Certainly in an audio medium, we can always tweak one to the left and one to the right of the sound mix, whether you quite get that all the way. I have to say, I'm also thinking of this as a stage show. I'm thinking that this would actually make a really tight 45-minute piece with lots of different action. Should also just point out hello to the cat. We will want to know the cat's name later. We do collect cats. Yeah, that actually this could be a really nice dynamic, tight sort of 45-minute show, with X number of readers and performers flying between parts and sound effects. I think there's a lot of room for sound and visuals and things that actually could go with this. So yeah, all of those things. I said stop me talking, and then I started talking again. Gina, save me from myself.
First, that was my cat just bombing the Zoom call. Her name is Lady. But to follow off about how this would be produced, because I was just thinking the narrators really are this piece's strong suit, especially whether you know the story going in or have no clue what's going on. The narrators are kind of that grounding force. I especially like the idea that you decided to split it up for both sides. Because again, even if someone was watching and had no clue what this was about, no clue who was what, at least they'd understand this narrator is with this side, this narrator is with that side. And as more characters and events are introduced, they're able to still distinguish who's involved with what. And I think it would depend on the medium, but you mentioned seeing this on stage. I'd be really curious to see how the battle scene be done. Sound effects and all that stuff, of course, but I thought from a stage production, it's interesting how leading up to this, there's the narrators kind of guiding the story, but we still have the name players coming in and interjecting and still having lines and interactions. But then we get to the battle and it's kind of just paragraphs of text, very descriptive text. And I think it describes the battle well, but I'm curious how that would translate to stage. I'm not saying I had the answer, but I would just be really curious.
I mean, there's bits which speak to that could be turned into, you know, elements of physical action. I mean, the other thing is thinking about the, you know, the play, the true tragedy of Richard III that we've done, which is true, and it's definitely true, as the Queen's men keep telling us, is that there isn't that much lingering on battles. Actually, and a lot of history plays, they don't necessarily, you know, go into this level of detail. It's something that plays don't do. And so there's an interesting thing. So in terms of the physical stuff, I'm thinking about there's something to be done with those archers, and, you know, and yeah, I see lots of people flinging themselves around in desperate physical theatre ways. But then maybe that'll just be terrible. Emma, were you wanting to leap in?
I'm not trying to think. Yeah, just kind of agreeing with what's been said, really. I think I like the idea of the two narrators as well. And I think it'd be great if also you picked it, if you were doing it kind of just with, you know, voice performances, two very different voices for the two narrators. I'm enjoying reading the narrator so far. I think it's very, very dynamic text, full of movement. And obviously, you know, the battle's described through all this amazing natural world metaphors. You've got birds, you've got snow, you've got lightning. So yeah, very, very dynamic.
And of course, you know, we can trim things out if there's bits where we think that's a bit much. Then you know, we're allowed to do that. He's dead. Eric.
That's very true. True is the tragedy of, yeah, no, yeah, I'll put that joke aside now. I was going to say that you could do the sort of steal or borrow the device of what was it? I think it was Solomon and Persida, where you've got like sort of the action actually happening off stage, and then you've got the commentators sort of actually on stage. They're kind of like presumably facing either the stage or, I mean, it, you know, facing backstage or, you know, whatever.
What, so they're out there with binoculars going, and look, it's happening over there now, kind of thing.
Yeah, that's kind of, yeah. This is in reference to a joust that happens, at least. That's what I remember, sort of joust.
Yeah, they're all sort of, they're standing looking over over the fence, aren't they? Sort of going,
Yeah, so you could kind of use maybe something like that where the action is actually happening off stage and just being described, maybe. Also, it would be cheaper.
Yeah, I like it when people think cheap. I really appreciate that. Our budgets are tight. Any other thoughts before we move on? No? Silence in the room. Okay, so we will continue. We just had the king sends to have Northumberland's aid, and that's Percy. I might standardise some of the names for a production. I have issues sometimes with too many names, even though they're the same person. Anyway, off to Ratcliffe is sent off to have a quick chat with Percy.
But Percy greets him thus: "My troubled eyes this night beheld my father's angry ghost, advising not to join with Richard's host. Wilt thou," said he, "so much obscure my shield, to bear mine azure lion in the field with such a general? Ask him on which side his sword was drawn when I at Toton died."
When Richard knew that both his hopes were vain, he forward sets with cursing and disdain, and cries,
"Who would not all these lords detest, when Percy chargeth like the moon his crest?"
This speech the heart of noble Ferrers rent. He answers,
"Sir, though many dare repent that which they cannot now without your wrong, and only grieve what they have been true too long, my breast shall never bear so foul a stain as any if any ancient blood in me remain, which from the Norman conquerors took descent. It shall be wholly in your service spent. I will obtain today, alive or dead, the crowns that grace the faithful soldier's head."
"Blessed be thy tongue," replies the king. "In thee the strength of all thine ancestors I see, extending warlike arms for England's good, by thee their heir, in valor as in blood."
But here we leave the king, and must review those sons of Mars who cruel blades imbrue in rivers sprung from hearts that bloodless lie and stain their shining arms in sanguine dye. Here valiant Oxford and fierce Norfolk meet, and with their spears each other rudely greet. About the air the shivering pieces play, even on their swords their noble hands they lay, and Norfolk first a blow directly guides at Oxford's head, which from his helmet slides upon his arm, and biting through the steel inflicts a wound which Vere disdains to feel. He lifts his falchion with a threatening grace, and hews the beaver off from Howard's face. This being done, he with compassion charmed retires, ashamed to strike a man disarmed. But straight a deadly shaft sent from a bow, whose master, though far off, the Duke could know, untimely brought this combat to an end, and pierced the brain of Richard's constant friend. When Oxford saw him sink, his noble soul was full of grief, which made him thus condole:
"Farewell, true king, to whom no costly grave can give due honour. Would my tears might save those streams of blood, deserving to be spilt in better service, had not Richard's guilt such heavy weight upon his fortune laid. These glorious virtues had his sins outweighed."
Courageous Talbot had with Surrey met, and after many blows begins to fret, that one so young in arm should thus unmoved resist his strength so oft in war approved. And now the Earl beholds his father fall, whose death like horrid darkness frighted all. Some give themselves as captives, others fly, but this young lion casts his generous eye on Mowbray's lion painted in his shield, and with that king of beasts repines to yield.
"The field," saith he, "in which the lion stands is blood, and blood I offer to the hands of daring foes. But never shall my flight dye black my lion, which as yet is white."
His enemies, like cunning huntsmen, strive in binding snares to take their prey alive, while he desires to expose his naked breast and thinks the sword that deepest strikes is best. Young Howard, single with an army, fights when moved with pity two renowned knights, strong Clarendon and valiant Conyers, try to rescue him, in which attempt they die. The savage red with blood of slaughtered foes doth them in midst of all his troops enclose, where though the captain for their safety strives, yet baser hands deprive them of their lives. Now Surrey fainting, scarce his sword can hold, which made a common soldier grow so bold, to lay rude hands upon that noble flower, which he, disdaining, anger gives him power, erects his weapon with a nimble round, and sends the peasant's arm to kiss the ground. This done, to Talbot he presents his blade, and saith,
"It is not hope of life hath made this my submission, but my strength is spent, and some perhaps of villain blood will vent my weary soul. This favour I demand, that I may die by your victorious hand."
"Nay, God forbid that any of my name," quoth Talbot, "should put out so bright a flame as burns in thee, brave youth, where thou hast erred. 'Twas thy father's fault, since he preferred a tyrant's crown before the jester's side."
The Earl, still mindful of his birth, replied,
"I wonder, Talbot, that thy noble heart insults on ruins of the vanquished part. We had the right. If now to you it flow, the fortune of your swords hath made it so. I never will my luckless choice repent, nor can it stain mine honour or descent. Set England's royal wreath upon a stake, there will I sight, and not the place forsake. And if the will of God hath so disposed that Richmond's brown be with the crown enclosed, I shall to him or his give doubtless signs that duty in my thoughts, not faction, shines."
The earnest soldiers still the chase pursue, but their commanders grieve they should imbrue their swords in blood which springs from English vein. The peaceful sound of trumpets them restrains from further slaughter with a mild retreat to rest contented in this first defeat. Just going to pause there. There's a lot of flitting going on in this sequence. I've already got some question marks already in the script as to who's saying this bit, which I don't know if I resolved beforehand whether that worked. It's not quite clear who's precisely how we move from one sequence to another. There's an Earl. I'm not sure if that's actually which Earl that is at that point. It had been Richmond, but at that point I'm thinking it's not. I'm not quite sure whose father and son
is
going on.
It may well be Surrey. Because that's during the fight with Talbot, right?
Yeah, we switch to Talbot with Surrey, but which generation is Surrey? Is the Surrey the elder or Surrey the who's losing
it's,
their father?
It's Surrey the younger, because they say his father dies, and that disheartens his side and it makes them desert. But young Surrey fights on until he gets tired and Talbot beats him.
But is that the same Surrey from earlier, or is this the another Surrey?
Well, earlier it was mentioned that Surrey was coming into combat with his father, and his father was like delighted to see his son do well. So I think that is the same Surrey.
Right, that's good. That's good. This I say these things to clarify because I get very confused. And yeah, we've got various additional little fights going on. What I quite like about this sequence is that it is a series of one-to-one combats. You know, whereas earlier we had this thing of how do you do the big battle bit, these bits are quite straightforward because they are, you know, a couple of people having a fight. Okay. One of them gets an arrow from some random person who... there's that random line, "whose master, though far off, the Duke could know." I mean, he could figure out who the archer was. Really? Could he?
No, it's the archer. The archer is the master the bow. The archer, even though he was far off, he could spot the Duke.
Oh, I see. Yes, the master of that arrow. Okay, good, excellent.
Eric?
I was just wondering about the bit that Oxford does, the farewell and so on. Is that basically, I wish I would have killed you, but someone else did first?
It's one of those things of when you're out there to kill your enemy, and then it turns out, oh, they're so noble. I'm so sad that I killed you. Wonderful.
It sounds a bit.
It was a great fight. It was one of those fights. I didn't want the fight to end, man. And to be fair, he didn't end in the fight. He got an arrow through him. So it's like, oh, come on. That's foul. Kind of thing.
Yeah. They fight. Oxford gets wounded, but it's not fatal. He hews off the front part, the face covering part of Norfolk's helmet, the bever, and then he retires because presumably he's wounded him in the head while doing that, and he's like, okay, I'm not gonna hit you because you're wounded, and then he tries to show mercy, and then arrow just goes and kills Norfolk right there, unfortunately. Mm.
So it's a busy scene, but we've got these different fights going on, and then we have this short reprieve. There's a mild retreat, just a hint of a soupçon of retreat from the trumpets there. There's a bit of a lull, which is probably going to lead us to our final unit of action, I suspect. I could be wrong. There might be some more additional. Yes, there's more additional one-to-one combats to go. Right. Any other thoughts before we continue? No? Fab. Okay. Narrator number one. Let's head back to the king.
The king intended at his setting out to help his vanguard, but a nimble scout runs crying.
Sir, I saw not far from hence where Richmond hovers with a small defence, and like one guilty of some heinous ill is covered with the shade of yonder hill.
The raven, almost famished, joys no more when restless billows tumble to the shore, a heap of bodies shipwrecked in the seas. Then Richard with these news himself doth please. He now diverts his course another way, and with his army led in fair array, ascends the rising ground, and taking view of Henry's soldiers, sees they are but few. Imperial courage fires his noble breast. He sets a threatening spear within his rest, thus saying,
"All true knights, on me attend. I soon will bring this quarrel to an end. If none will follow, if all faith be gone, behold, I go to try my cause alone."
He strikes his spurs into his horse's side. With him stout Lovell and bold Ferrers ride. To them brave Ratcliffe, generous Clifton haste. Old Brackenbury scorns to be the last. As born with wings, all worthy spirits fly, resolved for safety of their prince to die. And Catesby to this number adds his name, though pale with fear, yet overcome with shame. Their boldness Richmond dreads not, but admires. He sees their motion like to rolling fires, which by the wind along the fields are borne, amidst the trees, the hedges, and the corn, where they the hopes of husbandmen consume, and fill the troubled air with dusky fume. Now, as a careful lord of neighbouring grounds, he keeps the flame from entering his bounds. Each man is warned to hold his station sure, prepared with courage, strong assaults to endure. But all in vain, no force, no warlike art, from sudden breaking can preserve that part where Richard, like a dart, from thunder falls. His foes give way and stand as brazen walls on either side of his enforced path. While he neglects them and reserves his wrath for him whose death these threatening clouds would clear, whom now with gladness he beholdeth near, and all those faculties together brings which move the soul to high and noble things. Even so, a tiger having followed long the hunter's steps that robbed her of her young, when first she sees him, is by rage inclined, her steps to double and her teeth to grind. Now horse to horse, and man is joined to man, so strictly that the soldiers hardly can their adversaries from their fellows know. Here, each brave champion singles out his foe. In his confusion, Brackenbury meets with Hungerford, and him thus foully greets.
Ah, traitor, false and breach of faith and love, what discontent could thee in Borsia move, who's had so long my fellows been in arms to fly to rebels? What seducing charms could on your clouded mind such darkness bring to serve an outlaw and neglect the king?
With these sharp speeches, Hungerford enraged to uphold his honour, thus the battle waged.
Thy doting age, saith he, delights in words, but this aspiration must be tried by swords.
Then leaving fight the talk, he by his weapons speaks, and drives a blow which Brackenbury breaks, by lifting up his left hand, else the steel had pierced his burgonet, and made him feel the pangs of death. But now the fury fell upon the hand that did the stroke repel, and cut so large a portion of the shield, that it no more can safe protection yield. Bold Hungerford disdains his use to make of his advantage, but doth straight forsake his massy target, rendered to his squire, and saith,
"Let cowards such defence desire."
This done, these valiant knights dispose their blades, and still the one the other's face invades, till Brackenbury's helmet, giving way to those fierce strokes that Hungerford doth lay, is bruised and gapes, which Bouchier, fighting near, perceives and cries,
"Brave Hungerford, forbear! Bring not those silver hairs to timeless end. He was, and may be once again our friend."
But oh, too late! The fatal blow was sent from Hungerford, which he may now repent, but not recall, and digs a mortal wound in Brackenbury's head, which should be crowned with precious metals, and with bays adorned for constant truth appearing, when he scorned to stain his hand in those young princes' blood, and like a rock amidst the ocean stood, against the tyrant's charms and threats unmoved, though death declares how much he Richard loved.
Stout Ferrers aims to fix his mighty lance in Pembroke's heart, which on the steel doth glance, and runs in vain the empty air to press. But Pembroke's spear, obtaining wished success, through Ferrers' breastplate and his body sinks, and vital blood from inward vessels drinks.
Here Stanley and brave Lovell try their strength, whose equal courage draws the strife to length. They think not how they may themselves defend. To strike is all their care, to kill the end. So meet two bulls upon adjoining hills of rocky Charnwood, while their murmur fills the hollow crags when striving for their bounds. They wash their piercing horns in mutual wounds. If in the midst of such a bloody fight the name of friendship be not thought too light, recount, my muse, how Byron's faithful love to dying Clifton did itself approve. For Clifton, fighting bravely in the troop, receives a wound and now begins to droop, which Byron, seeing, though in arms his foe, in heart his friend, and hoping that the blow had not been mortal, guards him with his shield from second hurts, and cries,
"Dear Clifton, yield! Thou hither cam'st led by sinister fate, against my first advice, yet now, though late, take this my counsel."
Clifton thus replied,
"It is too late. For I must now provide to seek another life. Live thou, sweet friend, and when thy side obtains the happy end, upon the fortunes of my children look. Remember what a solemn oath we took, that he whose part should prove the best in fight would with the conqueror try his utmost might to save the other's lance from ruinous paws, which seize on fragments of a luckless cause. My father's fall our house had almost drowned, but I but chance aboard in shipwreck found. May never more such danger threaten mine. Deal thou for them as I would do for thine."
This said, his senses fail and powers decay, while Byron calls,
"Stay, worthy Clifton, stay, and hear my faithful promise once again, which if I break, may all my deeds be vain."
But now he knows that vital breath is fled, and needless words are uttered to the dead. Into the midst of Richard's strength he flies, presenting glorious acts to Henry's eyes, and for his service he expects no more than Clifton's son from forfeits to restore. And we're going to pause there before we go into the final furlong. Okay, we got more fighting. Brackenbury and Hungerford, and that's a savage, brutal fight there. I mean, that's just that just gets grim. It's even to the point where somebody else is on another part of the battlefield going, mate, no, no, just no. And then rather awkwardly, it just suddenly shifts to another fight. I think we need to switch narrator at that point just to make it clear that we're going to a different little fightette with Byron, a name that just sounds like it's from the wrong century, and Clifton. So yeah, but there's some fascinating action in there. We've had the hint earlier as well that Richard's seen the enemy far off, and he charges with all his mates. So Lovell and Ferrers and Ratcliffe and Clifton and Brackenbury, they're all off into the fight, and Catesby, who's not keen but goes anyway. I quite like that detail of Catesby going, I'm really scared. I'm not designed for fighting. I'm a middle management person. That's sort of where we are. Thoughts from the room. Anyone want to leap in on this? I mean, there's an element. It's supposed to be confusing because it's a battle, and that's sort of part of it. And I quite like that. But then narrative things. Eric.
I think there's that element that Gina mentioned earlier about the Richard not being painted in such a favorable light, sort of going, yes, I will go kill, I will keep fighting, even if all you other, and no insult here, keep sort of run. I mean, it's kind of, he's being brave, but also kind of not, kind of like, bugger what you all will do, I'll just go kill them myself.
It's a bit guilt trippy, isn't it? It's like, well, I'm going to fight. You know, I'll do it by myself if I must. It's not quite
pretty
that
much,
far.
Yeah.
And everyone sort of goes, oh, well, yeah, all right.
But then you get this lovely bit about, the friends were trapped on opposite sides of the war, well, battle.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, this is it is a civil war. That's the thing, is that, you know, these people might not actually, they might actually be friends in another context, be very together. Any other thoughts? Gina's absolutely right. That, you know, the narrators really do drive this, and the speeches are really nice, and I like the way that they hand the speeches to each other. I haven't unembedded, as it were, say if he's and things like that, and given that to narrators. I've left that just because it would have made the formatting too complicated. But I think we'd probably give that to narrators, and or just quietly allied some of them so that they're not necessarily there. But that's for future people to worry about. Any other thoughts before we go into the final conflict? Okay, Richard is off. He's off on his horse.
While Richard, bearing down with eager mind the steps by which his passage was confined, lays hands on Henry's standard as his prey, strong Brandon bore it, whom this fatal day marks with a black note as the only knight that on the conquering part forsakes the light. But time, whose wheels with various motion run, repays this service fully to his son, who marries Richmond's daughter, born between two royal parents and endowed a queen. When now the king perceives that Brandon strives to save his charge, he sends a blow that rives his skull in twain, and by a gaping hole gives ample scope to his departing soul, and thus insults.
Accursed wretch, farewell. Thine ensigns now may be displayed in hell. There thou shalt know it is an odious thing to let thy banner fly against thy king.
With scorn he throws the standard to the ground, when Cheney, for his height and strength renowned, steps forth to cover Richmond, now exposed to Richard's sword, the king with Cheney closed, and to the earth this mighty giant fell. Then like a stag, whom fences long withheld from meadows where the spring in glory reigns, now having levelled those unpleasing chains and treading proudly on the vanquished flowers, he in his hopes a thousand joys devours. for now no power to cross his end remains, but only Henry, whom he never deigns to name his foe, and thinks he shall not brave a valiant champion, but a yielding slave.
Alas, how much deceived when he shall find an able body and courageous mind. For Richmond boldly doth himself oppose against the king, and gives him blows for blows, who now confesseth with an angry frown his rival, not unworthy of the crown. The younger Stanley then no longer stayed. The earl in danger needs his present aid, which he performs as sudden as the light. His coming turns the balance of the fight.
So threatening clouds, whose fall the ploughmen fear, which long upon the mountain's top appear, dissolve at last, and vapours then distil to watery showers that all the valleys fill. The first that saw this dreadful storm arise was Catesby, who to Richard loudly cries,
I'm so sorry.
No way but swift retreat your life to save. This is no shame, with wings to avoid the grave.
It said, he trembling turns himself to fly, and dares not stay to hear the king's reply, who, scorning his advice as foul and base, returns this answer with a wrathful face.
Let cowards trust their horses' nimble feet, and in their course with new destruction meet. Gain thou some hours to draw thy fearful breath. To me, a noble flight is worse than death.
But at the approach of Stanley's fresh supply, the king's side droops. So generous horses lie, unapt to stir or make their courage known, which under cruel masters sink and groan.
There, at his prince's foot, stout Ratcliffe dies. Not fearing, but despairing, Lovell flies, for he shall after end his weary life, in not so fair, but yet as bold a strife. The king maintains the fight, though left alone, for Henry's life he fain would change his own. And as a lioness, which, compassed round with troops of men, receives a smarting wound by some bold hand, though hindered and oppressed with other spears, yet slighting all the rest, will follow him alone that wronged her first. So Richard, pressing with revengeful thirst, admits no shape but Richmond's to his eye, and would in triumph on his carcass die. But that great God, to whom all creatures yield, protects his servant with a heavenly shield. His power, in which the earl securely trusts, rebates the blows and falsifies the thrusts. The king grows weary and begins to faint. It grieves him that his foes perceive the taint, some strike him, that till then durst not come near. With weight and number they ground him bare, they to ground him bare, where trampled down and hewed with many sword, he softly uttered these his dying words.
Now strength no longer fortune can withstand. I perish in the center of my land.
His hand he then with wreaths of grass enfolds, and bites the earth, which he so strictly holds, as if he would have borne it with him hence, so loath he was to lose his rights pretence.
And thus it ends. It really focuses on, you know, Richard's death. That, you know, it's just sort of death by a thousand cuts. People all around him. He grabs onto the grass. He bites the earth. He's given poignant last lines at the end there. And he really does paint that picture of him constantly fighting through people to get to Richmond and doesn't quite make it. Taking out Standard Bearer, taking out another Cheney who gets in the well, who's a giant, apparently. This mighty giant. That may just be in terms of his standing, of course. Thoughts? Liza?
Yeah, I mean, my first thought is that the ending seems very abrupt. It feels a little bit unfinished in a way. There should be, you know, 10 more lines saying, and thus the great line of Tudor was established, and it leads to the even greater line of Stuart, viva la Scotland, give me some money.
Well, there's two responses to that. One, it's good that it's not there because it saves me cutting it. and two, it might be that it is unfinished. This was published posthumously. With a number of other pieces. So it's not impossible that actually that there's a thing. I quite like it. It ends in the same way as it starts. It starts sort of mid-action. And once the king's dead, what else is there to say? You know, they've already done a certain amount of Stuart arse-licking earlier. That it just ends with this image of him holding onto the grass and biting into the earth.
He's holding onto the physical world because he doesn't want to go to the next world where he will be judged, I guess. It might be the metaphor. But it's in terms of kingship and in terms of wanting to hold on to kingship and hold on to the land, it's a really powerful metaphor also.
Yeah, and it almost draws us straight back into the ghost of Richard III clawing his way out from hell to tell us his story. It's a really clear narrative for the most part of what's going on. Apart from minor tweaks, it really does flow quite nicely. And there's always a danger with a long poem like this that it's going to get sort of trapped in its own rhythms. But actually with rehearsal and planning, that's actually very breakable. And so it doesn't get monotonous in that sense. It has a nice flow to it that I like. Other thoughts about the ending? Anyone else feel it was too abrupt? Anyone else want more? Gina.
If anything, for the ending for me, I was kind of surprised with how it went. Just again, from the beginning, how we established how they set up Richard versus Richmond and how they were seriously building up Richmond. Like we just said, you would have thought there would have been a couple lines after just kind of establishing that victory, at least for this battle. So I was really surprised at the amount of focus that was on Richard. And on one hand, I could see us being interpreted with, especially as we're getting closer to the end with all this descriptive and how he's so focused on Richmond. I could see someone saying this is just showing like how it's inevitably coming to his end, that he's going to die. It's all kind of worthless. And I don't know, maybe this is just because I was reading Richard's part, but the ending there, I almost took it kind of as a 180, that they were giving him a little bit of that spotlight that they were giving Richmond. In a sense, with as he was getting closer and closer, like I got the sense of the drive that he was having in that moment, which again, I can hear people saying that it's to show that it wasn't worth it in the end. But to me, I thought it was really interesting how they gave Richard almost like a pass, painting him in a little bit of a better life, at least for like one paragraph there.
I mean, it's a really desperate charge. To a degree, the battle turns, and it's basically no. Well, if I kill the pretender, if I kill Richmond, then I still win by default, because it's whereas all the other forces have turned. The battle's going to be lost if he doesn't do something, and so it's this desperate sort of last charge. And on a historical note, is exactly what his father did. And that's also how he lost. So there's an interesting sort of like father, like son sort of parallel thing. It's not here in the text at all, I don't think. But that sort of desperation and the sense that this battle could, yes, the we know the battle's going to end this way, and we've got a ghost of Henry VI turning up and saying nice things to Richmond. But actually, in the midst of the battle, maybe he might just make it. Maybe he might just win. He might just do it. He might just get to Richmond. There is something there. Eric, I think you were waving earlier.
I was just going to be sort of not obscene, but I don't know what the word is. Anyway, just sort of because usually, like in plays that we've seen where people do or don't get a death speech kind of thing. He gets two lines, whereas Clifton gets like a whole, eight or nine. I didn't count.
More.
So yeah. So it's kind of, there's part of me going, well, the focus shifts, but ever so slightly compared to, like, I mean, you know which camp you're in, kind of thing.
Hmm. Yeah, Clifton, a person who's not prefigured at all, really, in the text, I mean, apart from a passing mention earlier, gets this rousing death scene. Whereas, Richard gets two lines and some insults and some stuff, you know. Any other thoughts about the ending before we go to final thoughts about the piece overall? Okay, so yeah, we've got this text. As I say, it's a poem. It's designed to be a poem. It's designed to be read. It could be recorded as just a straightforward single voice. I mean, I've arranged it for lots of voices, but it could actually just be read by a poet type person. Reading it as a single thing, and that would make a nice audio thing. I really like it as part of a show about Richard, as essentially the climax, the second half of a show, because it will be about 45 minutes, I think, in 45 minutes, 50 minutes, depending on cuts. It might be a little longer than that, but or even shorter, but it has a really nice potentiality to it. I like that because it's you can do things with it because it's not designed to be theatrical, so therefore we can do things with it to make it more theatrical and see what comes out of it. All sorts of options. I don't think we have the budget to think about it as a film. Just saying. I don't think we have the extras budget. Just couldn't afford them. The rendering on doing the army, that'll just be just too much. Final thoughts in the room about this as a performable text. Any thoughts, random or otherwise? Emma, do you have any final thoughts?
I've really enjoyed reading all of this. And yeah, like I say, I enjoyed the dynamism of narrator one. And I think it's quite interesting with narrator one and narrator two, how I suppose they are, in some ways, they're impartial when they're telling things, but a lot of the time they're very much invested in the two different sides. And I think you should definitely think about showing that in performance. I loved how, especially in that final speech from narrator one, the pace really picked up. There were hardly any full stops at all. And it really, really gets going. It's really exciting to read. And I think it's just so rich as well. I think it would work very well as audio. I think if you did it on stage, I feel like maybe it's because I've only read the narrator parts, but more of a storytelling vibe, because the language is so rich. You don't necessarily need to physicalize all of this, because that might kind of dilute it a little bit. You know, there's such detail in things, you know, about the flight path of a weapon and how it pierces the armor, and all you need really is those amazing words. I think maybe more as a audio or storytelling piece for me. It's great. It's got so much potential.
I'd love it when people say storytelling, because, you know, I'm just going, that's my job. Organizing storytelling events, that's what he used to do before some sort of plague thing happened. The good old days. You could sit in a room and tell people stories. Eric, any final thoughts?
Plague? What? Let's not start that now. It's an interesting piece, especially because, you know, it's not the kind of thing that we usually read. And compared to, another piece of text that we did yesterday, this Foil of Antwerp, which is basically prose, eyewitness report compared to that. This is more almost romantic in nature. Like, sort of, it made me think of sort of poems that you get about, I don't know, like King Arthur going out into, well, Arthur, pre-King Arthur, before he's and his knights sort of going out into, well, not the wild exactly, but going into sort of on adventures and stuff. And then eventually meeting death or glory or both. I think you could turn it into a stage piece, and you would have, I think the challenge would be to figure out how to, well, aside from, you know, what words to cut and so on and so forth, how to arrange the main players, so to speak, so that people can tell them apart, first of all, and second of all, so that you've got like sort of spotlight, or not. I don't know. It depends on how you want to do it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm, just because I arranged it with two narrators and then a couple of people doing the other voices, the way you could do it is actually, depending on how many performers you've got, is you actually just split the narration between everybody and then occasionally they're playing a part as well. But it's, you split it between two teams, so you always know that X is on one side of the battle and Y are on the other. So the layer, and that's the thing, is also to remember that, you know, narrator one and narrator two are not distinct different individuals. You know, it's all narrator one. that's an artificial thing that I have added for the sake of reading. Though it has an interesting effect actually, and changes the way it flows. Liza, any final thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, as others have said, I do like splitting up the narrators because it lets you. Rather than just being narration, it lets two people compete, and it lets each of them care, and I like, you know, the secret of being interested in sports is to care who wins, and I think this is true of so much of this poem that sounds basically a bit like the Iliad, but also a bit like a sports commentator, and. Okay, so I had an idea of how to stage this, right? Mm. Which is to get a liaise with someone who runs a stage combat class and get yes. a bunch of actors who are advanced at sword and buckler and at longsword and maybe some polearm people, although most of the combatants who have lines are noble, so they'd probably be sword or sword and shield. So that you could have badass fights as well as excellent narration and moving death scenes and people protecting their dying enemies in the midst of the press because damn it, you were friends once and lots of fighting. That's violence. Violence solves everything. That's my final word.
Yes, and Liza may be being ironic there. The thing is also that if we have a sort of performative fighty action, that doesn't have to be by the actual speakers. We could eventually have speakers doing things, and then we could have physicalized others doing the action, as it were, so that we almost have a semicircle of performers surrounding a fight pit. Where the actual action of the battle occurs, so that all the narrators become sort of almost choric. The budget for this is getting higher. I'm just saying this current pitch, you know, it's going a bit above the four or five voices that I had in mind. But hey, Eric, you wanted to leap back in.
I was just going to say you could totally do it like Matrix style, like slow motion kendo and all that stuff. I don't know, maybe just no. Probably not.
Especially
probably
the arrow. Expensive. Especially the arrow. The arrow, you know, coming across the stage. You know, you can do
totally,
all that
totally.
Stuff.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Just like that, by the way. That's perfect demonstration how to do that. I do a very good death, by the way, on stage. I was once renowned for my deaths. Anyway, Gina, any final thoughts?
Yeah, I really like this as well. When we were reading and going through it, I actually found myself kind of forgetting that this was a poem. And I mean that in the best way possible. I'm sure we've all read those types of poems that fall hard into, I guess, the gimmick of being a poem. And that can be very distracting from the content that it's trying to tell or share. And I didn't feel it with this at all. I thought it had a really good cadence, a good flow through story-wise. In terms of how it would rhyme with itself, I didn't find anything too distracting, or it wasn't distracting or gimmicky to me, which I think some poems, especially long form, can fall into. So I thought this was really good.
Yeah, taking this forward, it's definitely a practical proposition to do in many ways. And one of the things that I always aim with this is to look for multiple ways of doing things and doing things more than once. Just because we do it one way doesn't mean we can't do it another way. Doesn't mean we can't do just a straightforward single voice reading, or that we go all out and stage it with cast of thousands, fight pits, death and destruction, which seems to be the consensus at the moment. So, or if you'd like to see more of this consider becoming a patron and supporting our actual production work when we get around to doing actual production. You can join us on patreon.com/beyondshakespeare, or you can just buy us a coffee on ko-fi.com. /beyondshakespeare, or there may be additional links. All the links will be in the show notes. And you can support the work we do and help keep us in cheese by doing those things, or just continue watching these things, liking them, being there. Because oddly enough, if no one's watching, then we cease to exist. So all that remains is thank all the wonderful readers for all their wonderful reading. Thank you very much, everyone, and goodbye. How darest thou, villain, disturb my sleep?